Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Diana Wiley. I'm your host for Love, Lust, and Laughter. And I'm especially happy today because I have with me Dr. Serena McKenzie. She is a naturopathic physician. She's been in healthcare for over 17 years. We collaborate all the time. Hello, Serena.
Hello. Hi, Diana. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. And really glad to have you back on this program. Serena really is not only brilliant, but she's a very fun, nice person. She enjoys playful living, and that's what we should all be enjoying, ideally, I think. How did you come to enjoy playful living so much? I know that's a long answer, but...
Maybe it's the red hair. I'm not sure.
Yeah, you have gorgeous, gorgeous reddish auburn hair. Yeah, it's great.
Life is too short, I suppose, you know? Just having fun with
Well, that too. Life is too short. Serena specializes in sexual medicine. She does all sorts of other things, too, but really she incorporates the best of Eastern and Western medicine, and we have worked in tandem quite often, and it works out really well, and so, because it's sort of a, especially for female sexuality, it's a mind-body approach, and if you've been around Serena and myself, you will know, because we're both dealing with a lot of sexual dysfunction, that guess what? Sex matters. It matters a lot, doesn't it, Dr. Serena?
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. Sex, I think, has a relevance into so many different areas of our lives.
And people can get lots of information on your excellent website. It's drserena.com. And there's a whole page on or two on sexual medicine. But let's start with your kind of an overview of your integrative medicine.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, to me, the long and short of it, integrative medicine is whatever works. So, you know, the practice that I've developed is utilizing the best of conventional medicine, if that seems most appropriate, evaluating alternative options, if that seems indicated, and just weighing out the pros and the cons of any given scenario and what fits best for the patient. So that's what integrative means to me. I mean, you can also look at it as utilizing multiple specialists in any given clinical situation, such as you and I collaborating. And so, you know, there's a lot of different ways to look at integrative medicine, but I think ultimately what we're striving to achieve is the most ideal medical solution for any given person, and that's true for sexual complaints, absolutely. It takes a village to raise a child. It takes a village to help facilitate healing, especially in sexual dysfunction. So integrative medicine in regards to sexuality is a multidisciplinary approach.
And you say at the top of your integrative medicine page on the website, it is also a partnership between patient and practitioner in the healing process. And I know that the feedback I get from patients who have seen you will say, you know, you spend time with them, you talk to them, and lots of physicians don't make the time or have the time or they're not so comfortable with this, especially the subject of human sexuality. Mm-hmm. So you really make a difference in a lot of these people's lives.
Well, it's definitely not a very common medical specialty, and most physicians are really uncomfortable talking about sex. And, you know, one of the biggest referral sources to my practice are from gynecologists, and that often surprises people when I tell them that, because we consider urologists and gynecologists to be women and men's experts, health experts, and if a gynecologist is involved in evaluating the vagina all day long, you think that she'd have something to say about vaginal dysfunction, which is often the case for sexual dysfunction for women, and yet that's just not the case. Physicians are just not trained in medical school about sexual function, and we are not trained in how to effectively treat sexual dysfunction, and a lot of physicians are really just uncomfortable. A lot of people in general are really uncomfortable talking about sex, so making the time to talk to people in clinical practice is a very long, complicated conversation because then it goes into healthcare and healthcare politics and whatnot. But, you know, the simplicity of it is that I believe that's where really effective medicine takes place, because we can then put everything into perspective and put all the pieces together and help make the most accurate assessment of where a complaint is coming from. And there are fantastic doctors of every discipline who do that, and there's other doctors who, either due to restraints of their employment facility or their own personal level of comfort, just don't feel drawn to practice that way. So, you know, I think there's a lot of ways to do good in the world, and this is just mine.
Yes. When I was at UCLA at the Female Sexual Medicine Center, we did talk about the mind-body approach to female sexuality. And so I would first do, before the patient saw the urologist specializing in female urology, I did an extensive evaluation to assess the psychological components of each woman's sexuality, and basically that's a sex history. So we talked about the presenting problem, its history, what she's done to address it in her relationship, how she's coped with it, how it has impacted the way she feels about herself, and her partner, of course, because no pill will help a woman if she hates her husband.
Yep.
And we also address, you know, earlier sexual development, maybe unresolved sexual abuse or trauma, mm-hmm. values around sexuality, body image, including genital self-image. And I want to come back to that. Self-stimulation, whether the problem is situational or across the board, whether it's lifelong or acquired. So this is really psychosexual evaluation. And you do the same thing. I may do it with a little more emphasis on the psychology part of it, but not necessarily, because I know you're very well versed in that too. But doing that in-depth evaluation to get all the history, mm-hmm. is important.
Mm-hmm. It is important. You know, sexual concerns are usually multi-layered and very complex in terms of our relationship to ourselves and very complex in our relationship to others. There's no single answer most of the time when people have concerns about their sexual experience. So to have such a complex topic, it has to be attended to in all of those different facets. So the mind, the body, the spirituality, or whatever you'd like to call it, is all relevant, and those areas all need to be addressed when you're trying to assess and support somebody in sexual development.
I have found, and I want to get your reaction to this, that good sex alone cannot sustain a relationship, but bad sex or none at all can severely restrain it, mm-hmm. to the point of breaking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think also what's really relevant, what I've learned at my 17 years of talking to people about sex, is that there is a different inherent sexual temperature, so to speak, that each individual has, and mm-hmm. that some people are more sexual than others, and that sex is inherently more valuable to others. And so I think our job is not necessarily to tell people what it is they need to have, but to ask and inquire what they're looking for, and
yeah.
to help them find that. Because for some people, a sex life of, you know, intercourse once a year can be very devastating, and for another couple, that might be perfect for them. And so that's another area of just kind of complication in the evaluation and treatment of sexual dysfunction, is that how do we match what is so in front of us and not necessarily make assumptions about what someone needs or doesn't need? Because it's true that sexual dysfunction has enormous impact in couples. I mean, 3 out of 4 couples who are having marital issues tend to have a sexual component to their
three out of four,
you know. So if there's problems in the marriage, there very commonly are also sexual problems. And yet at the same time, there are so many different ways to be sexual and so many different ways to be fulfilled. There is no one ideal sexual state for any given person, and no one ideal sexual state for any given couple. So that can definitely create just even more inquiry, more need for conversation.
Well, exactly. And I have found that the most common presenting problem is mismatched sexual desire.
Mm-hmm.
And the assumption is that it's usually the man who wants more sex and the woman wants less, but not always.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then you get problems. We've shared a couple, well, we won't even identify the culture they're from, because, but they're, the woman has vaginismus, began to overcome it, and using the dilators, and then her husband began to get erectile dysfunction. There was just, it was too much.
Mm-hmm.
Too much pressure on him. So then his desire went down as hers went up, and as she longed to have more, well, she longed to have intercourse for the first time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it definitely, I see, I mean, as you do, there, any combination can exist. I mean, the couple I was in with right before we started now was a younger couple, and his libido is much lower than hers. So, you know, these, it can happen any which way. And if you're looking at, you know, gay couples, it can be, you know, it's always one partner versus the other has a mismatch in libido is almost universal. And it's really how couples learn to manage that or find a middle ground that's workable for them that becomes most relevant.
You said gay couples.
Mm-hmm.
There is some talk about lesbian couples sometimes having, getting to the point where they both have low desire. Have you experienced that? I haven't seen, it's been a while since I've seen, probably a couple of years since I've seen a lesbian couple.
Mm-hmm. Lesbian bed death, is that what you mean?
Bed death, mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Lesbian bed death, sure. I mean, absolutely, that happens. I mean, that, you know, that's not uncommon. And I think that there's maybe more, I think that's that cliche name, lesbian bed death, comes into play because it's perhaps somewhat more common. I mean, I hesitate to say what's common or normal,
mm-hmm,
but,
mm-hmm.
You know, I think what happens is that it's women can become more friend-like, more companion-like than erotic sexual partners, but that's certainly not specific just to lesbian relationships. That's often the deterioration of libido in a heterosexual couple or in a gay male couple or in a transgender couple, for that matter. I mean, I don't think there is... I don't think there is necessarily any gender certainties, but that is, mm-hmm. where I've seen the lesbian dynamic develop, where they feel very close, they feel like girlfriends, they feel less like sexual or erotic partners. But again, like I said, I think that's just really common, especially when you have children and you are in a long-term relationship. I think that's a barrier that a lot of couples face of how do we maintain a rigorous sexual excitement when we have, you know, kids to get to school or homework to be done or babies that don't sleep or mortgages to be paid, and there is an inherent drive towards workability in long-term relationships and in family structures, and many, many, many couples struggle with how do we still create playfulness around sex, how do we create time around sex. People are so tired, and that's a really common struggle. So whether it's a lesbian couple or a heterosexual couple, I think
yes.
There's some universal challenges there that are just true for most, you know. So, yeah, I think that there are unique challenges that can exist within gender orientation or sexual orientation couples, to be sure, but not necessarily exclusive challenges.
Dr. David Snarch talks about becoming too familiar with your partner.
Mm-hmm.
You're more like roommates, platonic roommates.
Mm-hmm.
And that erotic edge has gone. Some couples keep an erotic edge by opening up their relationship occasionally.
Mm-hmm.
But that's maybe another show.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you said create time for sex. Certainly couples with children, and I know you have small children,
mm-hmm.
you and your husband,
mm-hmm.
and don't you try to build in date nights whenever you can? And
oh, absolutely. I mean, I do everything that I tell my patients to do in my own personal life for a lot of reasons. But, you know, we have date night once a week, which is something I often recommend to patients to have once a week. And we try to alternate which one of us plans that night. And we have every 3 months we go away from our children for an overnight date. And that's another recommendation I often make to my patients, to have time outside of the home environment can be really valuable in stimulating and recharging a sexual life with someone who you've been with for a long time. And when you have rigorous lives, which most of us do, whether it involves children or not, career, what have you, most people have a lot on their plate. We live in a very busy culture. And so making that time is a real challenge, you know, making time to exercise, making time to sleep. Most people just don't sleep enough even. So, you know, a lot of people are in a position of like, wow, I just don't feel like I have time for anything. And what commonly happens is that weeks, months, years develop where you kind of walk past your partner in the hallway but really don't have a deep connection anymore, because it doesn't self-propagate itself once you are in an adult life. I think when we're teenagers, adolescents, young adults, there is perhaps a different timeline, a different schedule. For some individuals, after they've retired or later on in life, there is some regaining of that freedom in the timeline and restraints from work life. But for many adults who are, you know, in their 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, which is a majority of our population, there is so many obstacles to create an erotic and intimate space with partners, and that can be a real challenge. And that's a big piece of, you know, what you help coach people in and what I help coach people in, and making that priority and practicing is a concept I talk with my patients a lot about, that just isn't really a concept that anyone discusses in the area of sex. But, you know, if you wanted to learn how to play the piano and get really good at the piano, you wouldn't expect to practice at 11 o'clock on a Wednesday night when you're too tired to even keep your eyes open. And yet, you know, most of us are trying to have sex when we're just exhausted and depleted in the middle of the week. So I think
it becomes one more thing to check off their to-do list.
Yes, absolutely. Many, I hear over and over and over all day long that individuals are saying, well, you know, women in particular will say, well, you know, I'll have sex because I feel like I'm supposed to, but what I'd really like to do is just get the garbage taken out and the laundry folded so I can go to bed and just rest. And, you know, it's not a very hot, sexually stimulating state of mind to be in. And yet that is where a lot of people are having sex. And I think there's some level of after time where that's just not very fulfilling for many people.
Well, it isn't, and part of the, let's just go back to what you said about planning a date night, and I suggest this too for some of my couples. It can only be once every 2 weeks, but to take turns planning it, because then there's an element of surprise.
Mm-hmm. And there's also that encourages both people to participate. I think what is also common in terms of there being a discrepancy in libido in couples, there's also a discrepancy in who is motivating sex in the relationship, and that's usually the partner who has a higher sexual interest, of course.
Right.
But having alternating date night creations helps create a mutual motivation and interest to be engaged intimately. And, you know, I think the other benefit, which I talk a lot with my patients about, is that often the lower libidoed partner has the experience commonly of having sex the way the higher libido partner wants to. There's almost like a, well, okay, you want to, so we will do what you want to do. And that leaves that other partner not really enjoying the sexual experience necessarily, because, you know, I'll use her, but it could be a him, but that individual is not creating or generating their own interest in sex. And that's a really common contribution, again, to having a lower libido, because it's not really enjoyable or fun or playful or exciting if it's always on someone else's terms and doing something for someone else most of the time because you think you're supposed to. That doesn't work very well. So, you know, having a mutual creation of a date night or an itinerary for time together helps both partners contribute and have their needs met also, which is really important.
It is, and also it may help. I have found this true for some of my clients. where they take turns planning the date night, and when it's, let's say it's the woman, she's the one with the lower libido, and usually you'll hear her male partner saying, oh, she never initiates sex. It would just be such a turn on if she would initiate sex. Mm-hmm. So maybe there'll be, and sometimes there is, an outflow from planning the date night to actually initiating something. And maybe it isn't even intercourse sex.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe, yep.
It's oftentimes, too, that lower libido person, there's something that they are wanting that they're not getting, and it may not be intercourse. It may be intimacy. It's often
right.
Their emotional needs are not getting met. And a lot of people, I think, like to make the cliche that it's a woman who's emotional and that men just want to have the physical experience of sex. And that's just not true. I mean, men also need to have an intimacy and a safety and a vulnerability that they're able to engage in a relationship in order to have a long-term satisfying sexual relationship. I see that all the time in men, just as much as I see it in women. And that's what
I do, too.
Yeah, that often surprises people. They think, and a lot of times women will say, well, my husband just wants to have sex, and I'll just do it, and I'll just get it over with, and then we're all happy. And that's just not true. Men are not happy with that type of sex long-term because they know when a woman is not interested, and they're not connected emotionally in that type of circumstance. And so, you know, I think having that ability to communicate what the needs really are can sometimes be very groundbreaking in a conversation about sex and long-term sustainability in a healthy sexual relationship, because there's often assumptions of what one partner thinks the other partner wants or doesn't want that are oftentimes not actually the truth in that situation.
In this regard, I often say avoid psychic sex. Mm-hmm. A lot of folks believe, well, if you really loved me, you should know. And it's kind of like going on a treasure hunt without any clues. Mm-hmm. Communication is absolutely necessary. You know, especially in the light of day when you can see your partner's face and the subtle reactions, and you can say, you know, I was reading an article and realized that there are some things I don't know about what you enjoy in bed.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to create that kind of pleasure for you.
And also, our desires change. And I spend a lot of time talking to patients about this, is that, you know, as we age and go through different life phases, what we thought or experienced as highly erotic at a certain phase of life may not actually be the same thing that we find erotic now. And we can't know how those desires or interests change unless we explore them and are in communication not just with ourselves but with our partners. And that's extremely common. You know, when we're teenagers, we have one thing that we like. In our 20s, it's another. After we've had children, if we have children, then that can change. Menopause is a huge transition time. And, you know, when children leave and go off to college, that is another key period of when a relationship often has many changes that occur emotionally. And all of those things become very relevant in terms of what is fantastic sex. I mean, you know, even if you had your favorite restaurant on the entire planet, if you went and had the same meal every day, that is not, it's just not fantastic after a certain amount of times that you've had that same meal, even if it's a fantastic meal. So, you know, learning to cook up different foods is a huge piece that takes time, and that's, I think, a big barrier. People look at it as like, oh, well, that sounds like exhausting. But the point is that it's so worth it, and it creates such stimulating conversation and creates the potential for a whole new level of sexual satisfaction that when people engage in that process, it's so rewarding and it's fantastic to watch. And learning new things that are emotionally and sexually stimulating can be a wonderful discovery process. But it's not always a single bullet approach. It takes time, and I think anything in our culture that takes time is sometimes hard to take on when we're all so busy.
You mentioned earlier once every 3 months, and I say the same thing to my clients, go away. You know, then you make love in a new place, and the brain to produce dopamine likes novelty, so you get a little novelty. And I think being adventurous, you know, shaking up your routine, if you can, just doing it, trying new things together. Mm-hmm. And it can even help you see each other with new eyes. And if you do a risk-taking adventure, like I know you like to do this, river rafting. Mm-hmm. The experience can lead to a better sex later.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, and we have plenty of studies in addition that show that exercise itself can dramatically improve a sexual experience. So, you know, I think living life is in an adventurous way, and other ways outside of the bedroom has a huge contribution to what the bedroom looks like. And, you know, again, it does come down to personal expectations and personal needs in terms of what is great for any given person. I mean, I've had patients who having sex on a desk instead of the bed was a dramatic adventure and mm-hmm. was extremely different and stimulating, and that worked out great for them versus, you know, other individuals who take much greater, steeper stimulation requirements into consideration. And, you know, there's again, it's just what's true for any given person, I think, is the biggest piece of the initial conversation of what are we trying to create, you know, what's really relevant for the individual and for their partner.
One of the best things you said, oh, you say, I love everything you say, but back 10 minutes ago or so, is that you ask and inquire what the patient wants,
mm-hmm.
and you don't make assumptions. And, of course, that's true in marriages, too, that couples are often making assumptions without really checking it out.
Mm-hmm.
And they maybe have faulty expectations, too, without communicating.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and all those things are really very, very relevant. You know, I mean, from my perspective of it, I mean, as a sexual medicine physician, my primary goal is to understand any medical causes of sexual
yes.
concerns. But the reality is that all of these conversations ultimately are extremely important, and, you know, why most of my patients work collaboratively with you or, you know, talk therapist or sex therapist, because it's a relevant conversation piece, even if there is a medical contribution to, say, lowered libido or pain with intercourse or erectile dysfunction. Even when there are some other medical factors, these conversation pieces are still incredibly relevant and improve the outcome of increasing sexual satisfaction, even aside from the medical piece of it. So, you know, I don't think there's any avoiding the conversation, and I don't think it should be avoided. I think there's a lot of wonderful things to discuss, and yet there's a lot of resistance, I think, to having some of these conversations because they can be uncomfortable and they can take time that is hard to make time for. But in the end, it's really the only way I've seen people make dramatic improvements in their sexual experience is to really engage in the process of exploration with themselves and with their partner.
And often it does take, as you're pointing out, a sex therapist or naturopathic physician or somebody like you, somebody like me, working collaboratively.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to go to our half-hour break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about a little more about the sexual medicine you do. On your sexual medicine page, you have what are the most common types of sexual problems. And let's get a little more specifically into those. And this, you can find this page at drserena.com, drserena.com. Wonderful website. So stay with us, and Dr. Serena and I will be back in just a couple of minutes. We are back. This is Dr. Diana Wiley. I'm here with Dr. Serena McKenzie. Go to her great website, drserena.com. We had an off-the-air question. And by the way, this is a call-in show, so you can, if you want to come on the air, you can do that too. Call 888-874-4888. Off-the-air question, Serena.
Uh-huh.
I am 34, this is a woman, and have virtually no sex drive.
Mm-hmm.
I am ashamed. I'm sorry, go ahead and try to answer her because I'm getting over a cold here, so.
No worries. Okay, so, you know, and we can kind of use this into a segue of talking about the medical evaluation, and then you can maybe jump in with how you on the psychology side of things, address things. But, you know, for me, most of the, you said 37?
34. And she says that she's never had much of a desire for sex. She doesn't even fantasize. And when she tries speaking to doctors, they either say she's exaggerating or she's having a stressful period. In other words, they trivialize it
mm-hmm.
or minimize it, which we, both of us, hear this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So,
well, you know, I think that's not an uncommon complaint in my office. It's something I see very, very commonly. And, you know, when I sit down and talk with a woman who has that concern, we have a really extensive conversation about a lot of different things. And we look at a lot of different symptoms that may also exist. The most common things that I see for women in their early 30s are anxiety or mood disorders, hypothyroidism. I often do some laboratory investigation for low hormone levels. Side effects to medications are extremely common. Most common that I see are side effects to antidepressant medications. So, you know, there's a pretty extensive conversation to individualize that conversation about what's going on in any one particular woman's life, because there's very rarely one cause of sexual disinterest in every person who presents with it. It's almost always a combination of multiple things specific to that individual's life. So it's not uncommon for women to have not ever had positive sexual experiences in their life. And whether that means that they've had negative experiences in terms of having forced sexual experiences some point in their life, or having been raised in an environment where there was a lot of negativity around sex, or maybe there's just not ever been anything bad, but there hasn't ever been anything good, and sex has never been pleasurable or fun, or perhaps there's been pain. These are all very common presentations of women who will often say, you know, I just don't get it. It's like I'll watch movies, or people will tell me that sex is great, and I just don't get that. I've never experienced that. So, you know, there are a lot of medical rule outs that I look at. And then there's also the conversation of, you know, what would great sex be like for you? And for a lot of women in that circumstance where they say, I just have no interest at all, they really don't have an answer for that. That's very common. Sex has never probably been fun. So then the conversation also kind of dovetails into sex therapy of like, well, what are we looking to create, and how can we get there, and what does that look like? And, you know, one of the things that I often talk with people about is what is optimal sexuality? What is really a vital sexual experience, and what is that? There's some general characteristics that we see for that many individuals will agree on that's a sexually satisfying component, but there's also specifics to individuals. So that's kind of a long-winded answer to a...
No, it's a very good answer, and... So also birth control pills
mm-hmm.
will affect the libido, right?
And true, for some women.
Some women.
Oral contraceptive pills can increase something called sex hormone binding globulin, which is a carrier molecule for testosterone and DHEA. And so for some individuals, but not all, the oral contraceptive pill or other forms of birth control that involve hormones, such as, you know, the NuvaRing or injection or implants or even a marine IUD, less so, but there are many different hormonal forms of birth control that increase the sex hormone binding globulins and consequently decreases the amount of free testosterone, and it's the free testosterone that has most of the physiological activity. And so if there's an elevation in the amount of carrier molecules, then individuals can have a decreased exposure to free hormone levels. So that's one piece of it. And, you know, side effects to medications is extremely common. And for 34, you know, many of my patients have young children in the house at that age, or, you know, oftentimes there's a marital discord, or maybe a woman doesn't have a partner at all. And that can be another huge component to having no sexual interest whatsoever, is that they're just not, haven't found a partner that they find sexually compatible with.
Exactly. And women who don't have a partner, and especially if they have children, if they're single mothers, they can be so stressed out.
Mm-hmm.
I just recently had my daughter and her husband visit with their 6-month-old and 2.5-year-old, and you know, my son-in-law is such an engaged father. Mm-hmm. What a difference that makes. I can't imagine my daughter doing this alone because two little boys are demanding.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And yes, and I know you have a husband who's also very engaged mm-hmm. with your small son and daughter, and it makes a difference. I talk about the TTFS syndrome, which is too tired for sex syndrome, and the DINS syndrome, which is double income, no sex syndrome.
Mm-hmm. Yes, those are all
very common,
very real, and you know, I think people underestimate how much those factors come into play. And you know, because you know, you and I, we see people all day long, day in, day out, year after year after year. We see a lot of evolution in people's lives, and one thing that I have seen over and over and over is that an individual at one point will have all these concerns or no interest and et cetera, and then at another phase of life, either that person, that relationship will end that they were in, or they have an affair, or there's some new circumstance where every single sexual problem they ever had completely resolves within, you know, immediately, and that just says a lot about the circumstances in which we have sexual concerns. And that's not always necessarily the case. There are definitely individuals who have never had an interest or have had a poor sexual experience with every partner that they've had. But what's also very common is that, for example, for men, they will complain that they have erectile dysfunction with their female partner, but they don't have that concern with masturbation. You know, from the medical perspective, that is a very telling piece, and that seems obvious when you say it out loud like that, but most people don't perceive their own lives that way, and they don't perceive that a circumstantial sexual complaint is relevant to that circumstance. You know, when a lot of times it is. A lot of times, you know, when moms are sleep deprived or they have no space to themselves, or women who are high-powered career women and are traveling a lot, or if husbands are traveling a lot, these are very basic, you know, lifestyle contributions to sexual concerns, and yet because they're just commonplace everyday circumstances, a lot of people brush them off the same way that a lot of healthcare providers, it's like, well, it's just normal that you feel this way, and you know, it's dismissive, like you were saying earlier.
Yes.
And yet the relevance of these pieces is enormous in terms of how we feel sexually, whether we have enough sleep, whether we've had positive sexual experiences before, the state of our relationship. I mean, I have people very, very commonly who really are unable to acknowledge how much these factors influence their sexual interests, and they're looking for a pill or a medication or an injection or a nasal spray or a nasal gel. We have a plethora of options out there, and absolutely they're legitimate options that sometimes help, but ultimately at the end of the day, where I see people really make a difference in their sexual experience are when they identify and honestly assess where some of these aspects of their lifestyle are depriving them of a sexual fulfilling experience in their relationship or with themselves. I think women are very easy to oversee how much body image contributes to being able to enjoy sex, or being able to embrace whether it's a sexual orientation or a kink or something that perhaps is different from what people think they should be, how much influence that has on enjoying sex. So, you know, I think...
Yeah, because if you have serious body image problems or genital image problems, which I alluded to in the very top of the show, it's much harder to just let go.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And be uninhibited and have a great time.
Well, and a lot of times women think that, you know, or there's conversation that in order for a woman to have an orgasm, it's particularly important for her to be able to be vulnerable and to be intimate and to let go to have an orgasm. And that's absolutely true. What I think people don't understand is that actually is extremely true for men also, that men who have performance anxiety or body image concern or they have erectile dysfunction or they have premature ejaculation or delayed ejaculation, which is when you're unable to have an orgasm or an ejaculation during a sexual event. And those are all similar presentations of feeling uncomfortable and not feeling uninhibited. And to be uninhibited, you have to be with somebody, first of all, you like, which, you know, is not always the case for who we're trying to have sex with, which seems like a funny disconnect, but it's very true. A lot of partners don't like each other, and yet that doesn't seem to come into their mind as relevant. But at any rate,
I have a little sidebar which
illustrates. Sidebar. You typically need to like the person you're trying to have sex with.
Yes. But I have a colleague who interviewed hundreds of blue-collar men. So mm-hmm. these were cops, firemen, sanitation workers. Mm-hmm. This was in New York City. And their wives. And most of these men in this particular study were in their 50s. And they still expected to get an erection at the mere thought of an erotic adventure.
Yeah.
And so when Dr. Tiefer, this was a sexologist, suggested that at this age a man often needs physical stimulation, they'd say, oh, come on, doc, it's not masculine to have a woman get it up for me.
Mm-hmm.
And then interviewing their wives found a similar, expectation. He should get it up. You know, mm-hmm. if their husbands haven't taken any sexual initiative for some time, many working class wives often withdraw and live in their anger and bitterness. And I have seen this, although I don't have, because of my fee structure, I don't have as many working class people, but I do have some.
Mm-hmm.
And there is, see, we're back to expectations, right?
Mm-hmm.
And assumptions.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of men will take an ED drug and they don't know that they need a little help from their partner mm-hmm. to get that erection.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just going to happen.
Yep, absolutely, absolutely.
So we've already talked the most common types of sexual problems. Mm-hmm. We've talked a bit about low sexual desire, mostly for women. And we've talked about ED and delayed ejaculation. That's a harder, I have found that's a more difficult symptom to treat because it's, there's often a resistance to real emotional intimacy.
Mm-hmm.
I give you my ejaculate and I don't know, maybe this is too, psychological, but I have found it to be true that I don't want to, on some unconscious level, I don't want to share this much with you.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely, and I have found that delayed or ejaculation in men is often compounded with erectile dysfunction in that difficulty in maintaining an erection, and there's a lot of focus on the penis, I have noticed.
Yeah.
For me, clinically, in men with this complaint, that they're very focused on the performance of the erection, the performance of penetrative sex, and that there is not much, there's just this expectation that they need to have an erection and have penetration in a very specific way, and they're supposed to have an orgasm in a very specific, there's just a lot of boxed in thinking about what sex should be, and that creates a lot of anxiety for men, and a lot of times there's a distraction and or that racing the clock of trying to have an orgasm, but losing the participation in the event itself. It becomes more of a penis in the room versus a relationship or an intimacy.
Oh, that's very good, yes.
You know,
a penis in the room, not the relationship.
Yes, there's a penis in the room. And, you know, I think that...
The penis is misbehaving.
Yes. I think that, you know, in particular, a lot of the men in my practice really struggle with how their penis functions. And it's because penetration does not occur if an erection cannot be sustained, that becomes a focus of a sexual experience pretty quickly, whereas for a woman, she can fake it, generally speaking, less so after menopause with some vaginal dryness, but, you know, generally speaking, a woman can not be engaged, not be aroused, not be interested in the sexual activity, and intercourse can still occur, whereas for a man, that's not the case. If they're not engaged, if they're not aroused, if they're not involved in the process at hand, then they lose an erection, and then everything comes to a screeching halt. So I find that there is a particularly higher level of anxiety for a lot of men who have sexual dysfunction associated with their penis than there are for women. And I think that can be, in some ways, a good thing, because then it brings their attention to some problems other places more quickly, But it can cause a lot of distress, an enormous amount of distress for men.
One of the first homework exercises I give to many of my couples is touch homework, mm-hmm. sensate focus homework, where lots of erotic massaging and where intercourse is not even on the table for the first couple of times.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, this is good because this was Masters and Johnson's idea, but the sex researchers. But it's a good thing because, you know, from the top of our heads to the bottom of our toes, we have so many erotic, sensual opportunities. And some people get stuck between the legs. There are other things to do.
Mm-hmm.
And when intercourse is not allowed, because you and I have power here with homework assignments and things, then they may get in touch with more of their... I'm so sorry I'm coughing. This is really bad.
No worries. More in touch with their emotional side is what I think you're suggesting. And as well as what I would say as even an ambiguous spiritual side, which can mean a lot of different things to different people. And I think that piece is really not discussed very often in our culture. But I do believe that there is a very strong spiritual side of sexuality that
yeah.
is experienced by people who have very high libidos and who have a very strong connection to sexuality in their life and that have a sustained strong sexual experience as they age, is that there is the physical experience, there's also the emotional experience of intimacy, but then there's something more than that, which is undefinable perhaps for, you know, a group of individuals because it's very personal. It's very personalized in terms of what that means, but I have seen over and over and over that individuals who have that deep connection to their own sexual self and in combination with a partner have explored that. And that could mean a lot of different things. That doesn't necessarily mean any one thing, but there is an inquiry, there is a question and a conversation and an engagement in not just the emotional, but beyond. So, you know, restricting intercourse does give some opportunity, which is why it's such a classic sex therapy exercise.
Yes, it is.
What other aspects of sex are meaningful? You know, coming back to that same conversation, what is the motivation to be sexual here?
Mm-hmm.
Is it just to have an orgasm? That's a motivation for some people, but I don't think that is anywhere near as big of a gratification as most people assume that it is, and that there's so much more of a deeper connection with someone else or with a deeper connection to self that is far more valuable than even that physical experience, even though it is often the physical experience that people anticipate wanting. So, you know, for when the young woman called in earlier about I have no interest, these are so many layers of conversation that most people have never had. Of like, well, I'm not interested, therefore I assume I don't want to have sex because I don't physically like how it feels. When there is actually this emotional and intimacy and spirituality around sexuality that is also incredibly rich in being able to explore, and most people just don't have any concept of that and don't have anybody to stimulate that inquiry, and involving ourselves in all of those different areas can radically change our sexual experience.
You say it very well, and of course, going back to the off-the-air question, it's very likely that she's had some sexual trauma in her past. For 11 years, I co-led two women's sexuality groups in California, and all of the women had had sexual abuse, and they all started out in the groups not having orgasms, and many of them learned to have orgasms. But it's a process, and once the payoff is there, so to speak, because haven't you found that a lot of low libido women often are anorgasmic?
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, I think a lot of, like the woman who called and said, there is so commonly this shame and embarrassment.
The shame.
And to me, what I always say is that it's like, you know, if you didn't know how to ride a bicycle or play a piano, we wouldn't be ashamed about that. We would just look at it as something that we wanted to learn more about. And we have this somehow assumption that because I have my girl parts and, you know, the partner who I'm with has boy parts or girl parts or whatever parts they have, that we're just supposed to make these work and that we're just somehow supposed to be born with the owner manual of how to have fantastic sex.
The owner manual. Exactly.
The owner manual. And it just doesn't work that way for most people. And it's this big hidden secret and this big myth in our culture. Everyone thinks everyone else is having fantastic sex all the time. But, you know, you and I know as professionals who talk to people about the most intimate aspects of their sexual lives that most people are challenged or struggle or learn and develop and create something out of their sexual experience. Very few people are inherently born learning how to play the piano fantastically.
Exactly. You go back to your idea of practicing, which I like
Absolutely. And that is so true for sexuality. And I find that that helps relieve some of that shame and that some of that embarrassment and some of that guilt. And it's not that people have done anything wrong. This is not that there's anything that has happened that has to be ashamed of. This is simply something to learn about, something to become better at. And I think we all have this somehow, I don't know where exactly it comes from, that we're all supposed to be fantastic in bed the minute we decide we want to be sexually involved in our adult lives or adolescent lives. And I suppose that comes a lot from our media and a lot from, you know, our movies that show these tremendous acts of eroticism and orgasm and, you know, things that are not realistic. And having realistic conversations and expectations about how we become good in bed just aren't had in our culture very often. And so I try to help people understand that and remind them that, you know, being ashamed of not having a libido is not that different from being ashamed of not liking golf, which is the analogy I always use.
It's good.
Because I myself personally don't care for golf. I've never found it very interesting. And I'm no good
at
it.
You're too high energy, Serena.
What's that?
You're too high energy.
Too high energy, that's right.
Yeah,
I jumped out of a plane skydiving before.
I mean, it's one thing to talk about slow sex. In fact, I hear there's a new book called Slow Sex, which I'd like to read. The golf can be a little bit slow, I think.
Yes, perhaps that's it. But, you know, the point is that we all learn to be good at certain things in our lives. And there's areas where all of us excel at certain things and perhaps are less skilled at others. And if sex is one of those things that we are have less interest in or have less skills in, there, you know, it's always something that we can learn. And, in fact, that's what most of us do, is that most individuals learn how to be more interested in sex and that it's a process. And, you know, sometimes there's medical contributions, absolutely, and oftentimes there's not. And it's a interpersonal development process.
Dr. Serena, this has been a wonderful show. I think you've given us a lot of really good information and lots to think about. And, of course, I'll have you back. I think this is your third or maybe fourth appearance on this show.
I think third, yes.
Yeah, third. Okay, good.
Well, thank you for having me.
We'll have you back. And, listeners, please go to drserena.com for all of the information. And thank you, Serena. I look forward to seeing you soon and collaborating with you about various patients.
Well, thanks again for having me. It was super fun. You have a great holiday.
Thank you. You too. And good wishes to everybody out there for a wonderful holiday. And, you know, remember, sex for the holiday. You know, gratitude.
Amen.
Yeah, gratitude. Let your partner know they're desired. And that's a great gift, isn't it, Serena?
Absolutely. One of the best there is.
Yes. Thanks again, Serena.
Okay.
Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye. Take care.
Ti divertirai. Che traguardi vuoi farmi trovare? Vai con piedi. Vai con piedi. Tap, 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 tap. Oh, happy feet.